Good morning. We are broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. Appreciate that little bumper music. It is 55 degrees right now, partly cloudy. Sunny skies later today. We should see a high of about 77. A wild difference from a week ago when we were all sweating under the hot sun. We are wearing jackets and sweaters now in front of WCCO Radio's booth. It has been a long time since I have broadcast from the Minnesota State Fair, and my guest for the next hour is Jan Malcolm. She's the former Minnesota Health Commissioner and now head of a new task force to look at health care at the University of Minnesota. Jan, thanks for coming to the fair.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Well, here we are in front of a quiet crowd.
It's early.
It's early, as you found out trying to get in.
Right.
It's like, what? It opens at 7, so hopefully more and more people will come. A perfect day for the fair, though, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it is, and you're right. What a relief after the oppressive heat and humidity. I felt so sorry for the folks who had to work in that.
I know.
In that heat. But,
I know.
A lot of people do.
So. Yeah, every day they have no choice. So we're grateful that it's turned a bit and grateful for the fall. I wanted to have you on because I just think you're an interesting person. You've been through what I would call hell.
I would, too.
Of course, the pandemic, which it's hard to believe at the end of this year, we're coming on 3 years since it started. Doesn't it just seem like, what just happened? What did we just live through?
Absolutely. I think, it's something I hope we'll talk more about is it was such an important experience in so many ways, devastating. And I think it's really important that we spend some time talking and getting multiple perspectives on what did we learn from that and what should we do differently, not only in future public health emergencies, because we know we'll have some, we just don't know what or when.
Right.
But we learned a lot of valuable lessons and hard-won lessons, and I will be, I think it's the way to honor the suffering that so many people experience, certainly health, but, business, learning, so many things were disrupted. Shame on us if we don't really take a hard look at lessons learned and what we could do better.
Did it surprise you the anger and outrage and politicization of what went down in the months that followed the real heat of the pandemic?
Well, yes, it did. It did. And it was certainly one of the complicating factors that made the work so much harder. There was so much both misinformation, and it was understandably confusing because I think we still kind of have to remind ourselves it was a brand new virus.
Yeah.
It's still a very new virus. It's still evolving. Mm-hmm. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so much we did not know at the beginning. And as we learned more, the information changed. And I know that was frustrating for people to have the health guidance evolving. But that's really the nature of science, is it does change as you learn more. But yes, it was the changing information, but then the manipulation of information and the not just the misinformation, but the disinformation, people really spreading untruths that they actually knew to be untrue.
And people were very, very passionate about their opinions, true or not, as to the severity of it. I mean, many, many people I talked to were like, well, it's just like the flu. I'm like, I don't think it is just like the flu.
Right.
And it started a lot of fights. I mean, there were times where with my dear best friends, had to back off and say, I'm not going to fight this fight.
Yeah.
We're at a restaurant. We're having a nice dinner. I'm not going to have a knockdown drag out about.
It's true. I think it's a really good point that it touched something really deep in people's value sets and in people's views about the role of government. The hard thing for me was that people thought we were trying to mess up their lives just because we enjoyed it or something.
Yeah.
Although the restrictions that were not easy decisions were done to try to protect people, especially very vulnerable people. And it might have been a very mild illness for a lot of us, but for a lot of people, it was deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, at the beginning, and even throughout, as the virus kept evolving, it was not an easy thing to say, well, this person's going to be safe and this person's not going to be safe. And with especially before we had vaccines and treatments, the only thing we could do to protect people and to try to preserve the capacity of the healthcare system was to try to limit the spread of the virus.
Right. We're talking to Jan Malcolm, the former health commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health, now the head of a new task force on health professionals and training at the University of Minnesota. But we're reflecting this first little bit about the pandemic, that while we're not over it, the emergency piece is over. And that has a lot of people sort of resting on their laurels, sort of thinking that it's no big deal.
Right.
And I just got COVID again. It's my second time. 2 weeks ago, feeling better, thank you. Okay. And And but it's still pretty powerful. I mean, I was pretty sick, and as I told the audience last week, that I actually went to the emergency room because I couldn't breathe very well. And so it's nothing to mess with, even though we have vaccinations and we have boosters, et cetera, et cetera. So
that is the key. This is a virus that we do not expect is going to go away. It's going to be part of the circulating viruses, of which there are many. But the key now is that we have the tools to manage it. We have vaccinations. We have treatments. We have improved our methods for surveillance, for knowing quickly what's happening. Just the scientific advancements were really something to be proud of and to marvel at, how quickly that happened, really. But now it's up to us, really, to use the tools that we have, and I think to be mindful of the risks to ourselves, but also to our fellow citizens, mm-hmm. and our families, our coworkers. There are, you know, every one of us knows
our elderly
somebody.
Parents.
Yes, everybody. Every one of us knows someone who's very vulnerable to a really severe case. So just being compassionate with each other and being sensitive to the fact that for a lot of people, things have not gone back to normal.
Yeah.
Folks with immune compromising conditions are really, you know, the vaccines don't work as well on a number of people. Even if they would love to get the vaccine, they need that extra protection of people around them, being careful. And, you know, please still don't go out and socialize if you know that you have, that you're positive, because you don't know who you might be putting at great risk. So those things about, you know, when you're sick, just take those precautions. Stay home. And when you are going out, you know, be really mindful of who you're with.
Do you think, Jan, that we should reinstate any kind of mask policy now, given that we're sort of seeing a bump again?
You know, that's such a
political
that's
and
such
charged.
A fascinating thing.
And
though.
Yeah.
It's the question of, okay, so we know, and I know some people still don't believe it, but the data are pretty darn clear that masks are very helpful in helping to stop the spread and helping to protect people from being exposed by somebody else. So we know that they're a helpful tool. At what point do you mandate, do you require people to do it? And that's where I think it became really contentious, that people felt past a certain point in time that we should leave it up to people to make good decisions. And I would love to have that be successful, that if we all have the information, we are mindful of the people around us and the risk they may be at. I certainly intend to wear masks in the winter for a lot of reasons. I think it's good for protecting against flu, this RSV virus that we've seen a huge uptick in the last couple of years. So I think, and other countries, just culturally, there's no big deal to wear masks in respiratory virus season. They just do.
Mm-hmm. But here in America, and I think that it's about, well, being told to do something.
Exactly.
That sort of goes against the grain of who we are as a society. And I think that's the crux of it.
I think so. Yeah, and that's again, it's a reasonable debate to have. When do you need to use those tools of public health law or a governor's authorities to protect the broader community? And I think you have to be judicious about that because people's patience and tolerance for that has limits, and you want to use those mandate policies when there's a really clear benefit to it.
Jan Malcolm is our guest. Again, she is the former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, now head of a task force on health professional training at the University of Minnesota. And we invite you to call in or text in or come up if you have a question in the audience here. We're broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. 651-461-9226. That's the talk and text line, the city's one talk and text line. We'll take a quick break and be back with much more on this Health Hour on News Talk 830 WCCO. And we're back broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. Hope everybody's having a nice morning. It's early. We're at 7:23. It's 56 degrees. Actually, it's perfect fair weather. If you ask me, would you rather be like sweating with a fan on you, or would you rather have a nice little sweatshirt, cup of coffee? I see some folks out in front here with their coffee and their sweatshirts. I have my jean jacket. Our guest is Jan Malcolm. She's the former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. She's also heading up a brand new task force at the University of Minnesota on health issues. Jan, thank you for being on the State Fair porch here.
Thank you.
It's nice to see people starting to mill about and have their coffee. And our dear sweet Michelle, who keeps everything running here at WCCO Radio, just came over with a French crepe, ham and cheese, a little breakfast crepe. That sounds delicious at this hour. But I won't leave you, Jan. I'll stay here. We were talking about the pandemic because it's coming up on 3 years since the beginning that crazy time in March of 2020.
It's been over 3 years. Actually.
Yeah, over 3 years it came upon us with a blast of furnace air, and we've learned a lot. We've come a long way, but it's still not quite out of the woods. And reflecting, like you said at the beginning of the show, to think about what lessons did we learn? How would we do things differently in the event of another pandemic, of which you say we're likely to see in our lifetime?
Well, I think that's one of the things, and I don't want to be a doomsayer here, but
yeah.
We used to think these sort of things were once in a century kind of events. It appears not. I mean, just even with respiratory viruses, and that some of which didn't become a full global pandemic but were significant epidemics in different parts of the world, there's been a lot going on in the last decade or so. There's just a lot of virus out there. It has to do with the globalization of the economy, travel. Things just move around the world with lightning speed in ways that they didn't before. And we just need to be aware that something that happens in another country can be here in 24 hours.
Right.
And so we just have to be ready.
Right.
And I think, again, it's not necessarily just another pandemic that we have to think about, but any kind of new health threat that moves quickly and affects a lot of people. I think we learned some good lessons. We've developed some new skills in how to stand up, significant things like the state testing program, mm-hmm. or the big vaccination sites that were really important at moments in time where you couldn't find tests easily.
I remember the beginning.
Or the vaccines that were in such short supply early on, and people had a hard time getting them at the normal places that mm-hmm. they would get.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we learned how to supplement, the healthcare system in some really important ways, that we need to be ready to do that. And part of the problem is both the healthcare workforce and the public health workforce, we have less people working in healthcare and public health today than we did at the beginning of the pandemic. That's not good. We need to we need to rebuild these fields, and because we need that every day, not just in an emergency.
Do you think that the trauma of going through, for example, a nurse that suffered through day in and day out of death and then leaving the business, do you think that that's why people left, and do you think that it will be hard to get them back?
I think the experiences during the pandemic, both just the sheer intensity and pressure and unrelenting 3 years of a full sprint, just was very exhausting for a lot of folks. A lot of people have chosen to go to part-time, change specialties, change where they practice, or just change careers altogether, or retire if they can. So I think the pandemic certainly was an important factor. But we know that the health workforce is also aging. Particularly if you look at rural Minnesota, we know that a large proportion of the physicians and the nurses, the pharmacists, the public health workers are getting toward retirement. And we don't see enough people coming into the fields, especially to practice in rural areas or in some of our underserved communities. So we had a problem that's been growing for a while, but the pandemic just really exacerbated it. And it was both the intensity of the work, but also you mentioned earlier some of the really difficult parts of the contention and people being so angry and accusing their physicians and their nurses of trying to do them harm, and wanting treatments that the health professionals wouldn't give them because they knew they were dangerous. It just became very, very nasty in some circumstances, which is really heartbreaking.
I had a neighbor who believed that Anthony Fauci was actually financially benefiting, had some investment, some stake in it. Mm-hmm. And he got COVID, this neighbor, and he refused treatment. He refused all things because he was so mad at Anthony Fauci. Oh. And he died.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I know.
That's a tragic story.
It's a terrible story.
Yeah.
Like, he died at home by himself of this illness because he refused care because he was so upset and angry at the system. And I just think that's the intensity with which so many people really felt that it's all a bunch of hooey and they're just trying to get us. And it just feels funny because it's like at no point was anything malicious.
Right.
The effort and the intensity and... It just feels funny because it's like at no point was anything malicious.
Right.
The effort and the intensity and the decisions that were made to try to help people not die. That was it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge, there were costs to those things. And
sure.
That's very clear. I mean, people's businesses, with the learning, disruption to learning with kids, not being in person.
We're still seeing that.
It's a big deal. And I think that's why it's so important to take stock of, what did we learn? What would we do differently? Now, I think, if we could have more quickly gotten schools to adapt, and adopt policies to keep the school environment safer, would be a great goal to, let's, for heaven's sakes, improve the ventilation in the schools and have things like testing and vaccinations and rapid access to treatment for the teachers and whatever. I mean, just thinking about how to prepare and how to protect some of these critical sectors and nursing homes. Oh my gosh,
that was terrible.
Yeah, what a heartbreak. So how do we do a better job? I mean, nursing homes have struggled for a long time with infection control. They're short staffed. They need more training. They need more people. And along comes a pandemic into a situation that was already stressed.
Right.
So again, another thing that I think was such an important learning is how connected all these parts are. The hospitals were too full, both because not enough people were taking preventive actions, but they also couldn't discharge people to the nursing homes because the nursing homes didn't have enough staff to take patients.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is connected, and we have to really be mindful of, you can't fix one problem in isolation and expect it to stay fixed. You got to look at the whole system.
Which kind of leads us to your conversation about the work that you're doing at the University of Minnesota. So why don't we do this? It's 7:32. We'll take a break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll do some weather. We'll let folks know what the temperature is and what it's going to be today and the next couple of days. And when we come back, we'll talk more with Jan Malcolm, former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, as well about her new task force on health professional training at the University of Minnesota. We're back on 830 WCCO, broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. And we're back. We're broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. It is 7:36 on a Sunday morning. Happy to have you with us. Nice to see people out milling about. The sun is shining. It's a little, I'd say, brisk, 56 right now. But, you know, we cannot complain about the weather because it was brutal last week, and so now we're finally reaping the rewards of a kind of a nice fall morning. Folks have got their coffee and a donut or whatever they're eating over there. I can't quite see, but it is making me hungry.
Me too.
We have
to, I hope you get a breakfast break at some point.
I'm going to run over there. We're talking to Jan Malcolm. She's on the porch, too. Jan is the former health commissioner for Minnesota. Also, she has a new job. She retired from that. And now tell us about this job, this task force. What's the mission of the task force?
Well, I'm really honored that Governor Walz asked me to chair a task force to help look at some of the challenges that are facing particularly the University of Minnesota's health professions, health sciences programs, certainly the medical school, but also the nursing school and the School of Public Health and the School of Dentistry and all these important healthcare providers that, boy, look what we just lived through and how dependent we are on excellent healthcare workers and excellent public health workers to take care of us every day, not just in emergencies. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the aging of a lot of folks, particularly in rural areas and in some of our communities that don't have enough access to providers. And so that's been an issue. You know, how do you make sure that we keep training world-class health professionals to meet the needs of the state? And the university, and there are other, you know, important training institutions around the state too. So this is sort of about how does the state support the continued training of world-class health professionals. The university trains the great majority of certainly the physicians in the state. And we're just looking at some trends that make us concerned about the need to make sure that we're supporting that training pipeline, because it's sort of so key to everything else. If we can't either do prevention or treatment to the standards that we've come to rely on, if we don't have a really high class workforce,
and so how do you do that? Yeah, I was going to ask, what's the solution?
Well, I think part of the issue is that we've got a pretty complicated healthcare system.
You know? I'll say,
yeah. I mean, we've got insurance, and we've got health systems competing with each other, and you know,
mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah, and everybody's rightly concerned about the cost of healthcare and the insurance premiums. And so in that environment, things like teaching and research tend to get squeezed. You know, it's sort of that pressure between the short term and the long term. And so the question is really, well, is there, what can the state do, you know, to support that, those public aspects of the mission of training health professions?
Is it about incentivizing? Is it about, you know, what do you do to attract people to get into the field? Like, are there things you can say, you get a bonus or you get a a new car.
Nice idea. Yeah. Yes, I think all, and there are some programs, and certainly the federal government's very important in how we pay for health professions training, but we do a number of things at the state to try to support that too. So it's time to just kind of look at how are those programs working, and do we need to do more, and what more can we do, and is there, you know, kind of just thinking about who all benefits from the health workforce and what should be the way that the university partners with other health systems, with other schools, with the, you know, the technology industries that are so dependent on the health workforce. It's kind of like, again, it's kind of a good lesson from the pandemic that things don't happen just magically. They right. happen, you know, with a strategy and with resources and with a plan.
Right.
And we just, I think it's a really valuable time to kind of take stock of what's happening to the health workforce in Minnesota and how do we support it and strengthen it.
651-461-9226. That's the number if you can call, or you can text that on our Cities One Talk and text line. And we have folks back at the station that can get us that information if you have a question. Anyone listening out in the audience as well, if you have a question, you can jump up here on the porch and ask. But we're talking about this new task force. Tell me when it's going to start and what's the game plan.
This is this was created by the governor through an executive order just a couple weeks ago, and it's so under the executive order there will be 15 members of this task force. I'm the volunteer chair, so it's not a job exactly, but it's something I'm very happy to support and work with some of our leaders in the health environment on. So folks who are interested can apply on the Secretary of State's website, and the executive order specifies we need, you know, people with rural healthcare experience, people with experience in training, a diverse workforce, people who know about healthcare finance, a couple people specifically from the university, the medical school, and elsewhere in the university. People representing other health systems. So there are kind of criteria or skills or experiences that we're looking for on the task force. And that should be named in the middle of September, we hope, and get going with our first meetings at the end of September. It's a short task force. We are due to make a report to the governor and the legislature in January.
Oh.
So we are not going to solve all the problems of health care.
You're going to make recommendations, though.
Yeah. It is to say, what are some options for how the U might partner differently? What can we learn from other states? We're not the only ones confronting health workforce challenges. What are others doing?
Yeah.
So we'll surface some options, make some recommendations really aimed at helping the governor and the legislature kind of process the requests that they've already gotten from the university for more resources to support this mission.
How important is straight up money to incentivizing? I mean, like, because we know, like, the healthcare professionals, the personal service helpers, the pay is still terrible for a lot of people that are in health care. I mean, would that be a part of the solution?
Well, that's how do you make the workforce attractive, as you were saying earlier? You know, and certainly pay is an important thing. How do we, you know, and look at the parts of the system where we really have huge shortages. You mentioned personal care attendants, long-term care workers, primary care, mental health and behavioral health specialists.
Sure.
I mean, we you know, and that too has to do with what are the pay scales for those jobs. It's a lot more lucrative to become a super specialist than a primary care doc, but we really have a critical need for some of those basic skill sets as well.
And I would imagine too, to some degree, perhaps the communities themselves that need the primary doctor might have. So if it's a Thief River Falls or it's a Mankato or, you know, Wilmer, that those communities might find ways as well to make themselves more attractive to those providers.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that we do with some state funding, not a lot of state funding, but for instance, there's a program that helps support residency slots in some of those very communities, because we know that if people practice in a community, get trained in a community, it's more likely that they'll stay there.
Sure.
Practice in a similar environment. So there are things that we are already doing that we can look at how well is that working and can we beef it up. But I do think there are some other models in other states to look at, because again, it's like this is the public missions of teaching and research are kind of embedded in this really complicated healthcare financing world that's all about competition, and it's the market can't fix everything.
No.
I think there's a real role for market forces in competition, but there are also these kind of public aspects to the mission that need to be kept front and center.
It's very convoluted, and I'm constantly scratching my head about how wacky the healthcare system is in terms of money, and that, you know, there was a great article in Time magazine several years ago called The Poison Pill. And it was about the fact that, like, okay, so I break my arm and I don't have insurance. How much does it cost? Okay, I break my arm and I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and this is how much it costs to fix it. Mm-hmm. I break my arm and I'm on Medicaid, and this is how much it costs. So there's no cost. There's no straight up, okay, you break your arm, you're going to put a cast on, it costs $100. It's so messed up to me, and I don't know how you fix it, because I think the horse is out of the barn. I mean, insurance is here, Medicaid, Medicare, blah, blah, yeah. blah.
Well, and again, I think just want to reinforce, we've got a specific mission and a short timeline. So all those things that you just mentioned are part of the complicating factors that make us need to ask the question, okay, given the complexity of the healthcare marketplace, what does that mean for how we support the training of our future health professionals, and how should we make sure that we continue to be at the leading edge of research? We have so much to be proud of with our health system in Minnesota, both our health care and our public health. Again, we worked our hearts out during the pandemic, and I think, you know, time will, I think, just continue to show that we, you know, while not perfect by any means, we actually performed pretty well as a state, and that was due to the incredible hard work and skill of so many people. And we are right to be proud of healthcare and health in Minnesota, but we can't take it for granted. We have to be really mindful of, you know, the current challenges and what we're going to do differently in the future to meet some of those the things that we didn't worry so much about the pipeline for. Or where people were practicing. We've lost so much access in rural Minnesota. It's a real concern. So we have to figure out what are we going to do about that.
Sure. All right, we have to take our final break. It is 7:48 on News Talk 830 WCCO. My name is Susan Jones. Susan Jones. Why did I say that?
I
haven't. My mom calls me Susan Jones when I'm in trouble. Susie Jones is my name. 651-461-9226. We're back after this on News Talk 830 WCCO. Welcome back. It is 7:54 on a Sunday morning. Fair starting to pick up. You can kind of feel the energy out there. Folks are milling about, having their coffee, having their donuts, having their crepes with ham and cheese, which I will be popping over. Jan Malcolm is our guest. She's the former health commissioner for the state of Minnesota. Jan, we have about, 1 minute. Isn't that terrible?
Wow, it goes fast.
So what we'll do is have you back on when the report is ready. We'll talk about the
report.
That'd
be great.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, I know you're off to your place up north. I hope you have a wonderful week.
Thank you. It's been, I just want to say what it means. These last years have been difficult, but it's also been an enormous privilege to serve Minnesota.
Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate your courage as well in the fact that I know that it was not easy dealing with the public who was very emotional. So thank you so much, Jan Malcolm, former commissioner of the state of Minnesota, Susie Jones, and we're back with your money on WCCO coming up right after this from the Minnesota State Fair. Good morning. We are broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. Appreciate that little bumper music. It is 55 degrees right now, partly cloudy. Sunny skies later today. We should see a high of about 77. A wild difference from a week ago when we were all sweating under the hot sun. We are wearing jackets and sweaters now in front of WCCO Radio's booth. It has been a long time since I have broadcast from the Minnesota State Fair, and my guest for the next hour is Jan Malcolm. She's the former Minnesota Health Commissioner and now head of a new task force to look at health care at the University of Minnesota. Jan, thanks for coming to the fair.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Well, here we are in front of a quiet crowd.
It's early.
It's early, as you found out trying to get in.
Right.
It's like, what? It opens at 7, so hopefully more and more people will come. A perfect day for the fair, though, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it is, and you're right. What a relief after the oppressive heat and humidity. I felt so sorry for the folks who had to work in that.
I know.
In that heat. But,
I know.
A lot of people do.
So. Yeah, every day they have no choice. So
right.
We're grateful that it's turned a bit and grateful for the fall. I wanted to have you on because I just think you're an interesting person. You've been through what I would call hell.
I would, too.
Of course, the pandemic, which it's hard to believe at the end of this year, we're coming on 3 years since it started. Doesn't it just seem like, what just happened? What did we just live through?
Absolutely. I think, it's something I hope we'll talk more about is it was such an important experience in so many ways, devastating. And I think it's really important that we spend some time talking and getting multiple perspectives on what did we learn from that and what should we do differently, not only in future public health emergencies, because we know we'll have some, we just don't know what or when.
Right.
But we learned a lot of valuable lessons and hard-won lessons, and I will be, I think it's the way to honor the suffering that so many people experience, certainly health, but business, learning, so many things were disrupted. Shame on us if we don't really take a hard look at lessons learned and what we could do better.
Did it surprise you the anger and outrage and politicization of what went down in the months that followed the real heat of the pandemic?
Well, yes, it did. It did. And it was certainly one of the complicating factors that made the work so much harder. There was so much both misinformation, and it was understandably confusing because I think we still kind of have to remind ourselves it was a brand new virus.
Yeah.
It's still a very new virus. It's still evolving.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so much we did not know at the beginning. And as we learned more, the information changed. And I know that was frustrating for people to have the health guidance evolving. But that's really the nature of science, is it does change as you learn more. But yes, it was the changing information, but then the manipulation of information and the not just the misinformation, but the disinformation, people really spreading untruths that they actually knew to be untrue.
And people were very, very passionate about their opinions, true or not, as to the severity of it. I mean, many, many people I talked to were like, well, it's just like the flu. I'm like, I don't think it is just like the flu.
Right.
And it started a lot of fights. I mean, there were times where with my dear best friends, had to back off and say, I'm not going to fight this fight.
Yeah.
We're at a restaurant. We're having a nice dinner. I'm not going to have a knockdown drag out about.
It's true. I think it's a really good point that it touched something really deep in people's value sets and in people's views about the role of government. The hard thing for me was that people thought we were trying to like mess up their lives just because we enjoyed it or something.
Yeah.
It was all the restrictions that were not easy decisions were done to try to protect people, especially very vulnerable people. And it might have been a very mild illness for a lot of us, but for a lot of people, it was deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, at the beginning, and even throughout, as the virus kept evolving, it was not an easy thing to say, well, this person's going to be safe and this person's not going to be safe. And with especially before we had vaccines and treatments, the only thing we could do to protect people and to try to preserve the capacity of the healthcare system was to try to limit the spread of the virus.
Right. We're talking to Jan Malcolm, the former health commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health, now the head of a new task force on health professionals and training at the University of Minnesota. But we're reflecting this first little bit about the pandemic, that while we're not over it, the emergency piece is over. And that has a lot of people sort of resting on their laurels, sort of thinking that it's no big deal.
Right.
And I just got COVID again. It's my second time. 2 weeks ago, feeling better, thank you. And but it's still pretty powerful. I mean, I was pretty sick, and as I told the audience last week, that I actually went to the emergency room because I couldn't breathe very well. And so it's nothing to mess with, even though we have vaccinations and we have boosters, et cetera, et cetera. So
that is the key. This is a virus that we do not expect is going to go away. It's going to be part of the circulating viruses, of which there are many. But the key now is that we have the tools to manage it. We have vaccinations. We have treatments. We have improved our methods for surveillance, for knowing quickly what's happening. Just the scientific advancements were really something to be proud of and to marvel at, how quickly that happened, really. But now it's up to us, really, to use the tools that we have, and I think to be mindful of the risks to ourselves, but also to our fellow citizens, mm-hmm. and our families, our coworkers. There are, you know, every one of us knows
our elderly
somebody.
Parents.
Yes, every one of us knows someone who's very vulnerable to a really severe case. So just being compassionate with each other and being sensitive to the fact that for a lot of people, things have not gone back to normal.
Yeah.
Folks with immune compromising conditions are really, you know, the vaccines don't work as well on a number of people, even if they would love to get the vaccine.
Yeah.
They need that extra protection of people around them, being careful. And, you know, please still don't go out and socialize if you know that you have, that you're positive, because you don't know who you might be putting at great risk. So those things about, you know, when you're sick, just take those precautions. Stay home, and when you are going out, you know, be really mindful of who you're with.
Do you think, Jan, that we should reinstate any kind of mask policy now, given that we're sort of seeing a bump again?
You know, that's such a
political
that's
and
such
charged
a fascinating thing. Though. It's the question of, okay, so we know, and I know some people still don't believe it, but the data are pretty darn clear that masks are very helpful in helping to stop the spread and helping to protect people from being exposed by somebody else. So we know that they're a helpful tool. At what point do you mandate, do you require people to do it? And that's where I think it became really contentious, that people felt past a certain point in time that we should leave it up to people to make good decisions. And I would love to have that be successful, that if we all have the information, we are mindful of the people around us and the risk they may be at. I certainly intend to wear masks in the winter for a lot of reasons. I think it's good for protecting against flu, this RSV virus that we've seen a huge uptick in the last couple of years. So I think, and other countries, just culturally, there's no big deal to wear masks in respiratory virus season. They just do.
Mm-hmm. But here in America, and I think that it's about, well, being told to do something.
Exactly.
That sort of goes against the grain of who we are as a society. And I think that's the crux of it.
I think so, yeah. And that's, again, it's a reasonable debate to have. When do you need to when do you need to use those tools of public health law or a governor's, you know, authorities to protect the broader community. And I think you have to be judicious about that, because people's patience and tolerance for that has limits, and you want to use those mandate policies when there's a really clear benefit to it.
Jan Malcolm is our guest. Again, she is the former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, now head of a task force on health professional training at the University of Minnesota. And we invite you to call in or text in or come up if you have a question in the audience here. We're broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. 651-461-9226. That's the talk and text line, the city's one talk and text line. We'll take a quick break and be back with much more on this Health Hour on News Talk 830 WCCO. And we're back broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. Hope everybody's having a nice morning. It's early. We're at 7:23. It's 56 degrees. Actually, it's perfect fair weather. If you ask me, would you rather be like sweating with a fan on you, or would you rather have a nice little sweatshirt, cup of coffee? I see some folks out in front here with their coffee and their sweatshirts. I have my jean jacket. Our guest is Jan Malcolm. She's the former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. She's also heading up a brand new task force at the University of Minnesota on health issues. Jan, thank you for being on the State Fair porch here.
Thank you. Nice
to be here. To see people starting to mill about and have their coffee, and our dear sweet Michelle, who keeps everything running here at WCCO Radio, just came over with a French crepe, ham and cheese, a little breakfast crepe. That sounds delicious at this hour. But I won't leave you, Jan. I'll stay here. We were talking about the pandemic, because it's coming up on 3 years since the beginning, that crazy time in March of 2020.
So it's been over 3 years, actually.
Yeah, over 3 years it came upon us with a blast of furnace air, and we've learned a lot. We've come a long way, but it's still not quite out of the woods. And reflecting, like you said at the beginning of the show, to think about what lessons did we learn? How would we do things differently in the event of another pandemic, of which you say we're likely to see in our lifetime?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the things, and I don't want to be a doomsayer. You know, we used to think these sort of things were once in a century kind of events. You know, it appears not. I mean, just even with respiratory viruses, and that some of which didn't become a full global pandemic but were significant epidemics in different parts of the world, there's been a lot going on in the last decade or so. There's just a lot of virus out there. You know, it has to do with the globalization of the economy, travel. Things just move around the world with lightning speed in ways that they didn't before. And we just need to be aware that something that happens in another country can be here in 24 hours.
Right.
And so we just have to be ready.
Right.
And I think, again, it's not necessarily just another pandemic that we have to think about, but any kind of new health threat that moves quickly and affects a lot of people. I think we learned some good lessons. We've developed some new skills in how to stand up, you know, significant things like the state testing program, mm-hmm. or the big vaccination sites that were really important at moments in time where you couldn't find tests easily, or
I remember the beginning,
or the vaccines that were in such short supply early on, and people had a hard time getting them at the normal places that mm-hmm. they would get. Mm-hmm. So I think we learned how to supplement, you know, the healthcare system in some really important ways, that we need to be ready to do that. And part of the problem is both the healthcare workforce and the public health workforce, we have less people working in healthcare and public health today than we did at the beginning of the pandemic. That's not good. We need to rebuild these fields, because we need that every day, not just in an emergency.
Do you think that the trauma of going through, for example, a nurse that suffered through day in and day out of death and then leaving the business. Do you think that that's why people left, and do you think that it will be hard to get them back?
I think the experiences during the pandemic, both just the sheer intensity and pressure and unrelenting 3 years of a full sprint, just was very exhausting for a lot of folks. A lot of people have chosen to go to part-time, change specialties, change where they practice, or just change careers altogether, or retire if they can. So I think the pandemic certainly was an important factor. But we know that the health workforce is also aging. Particularly, if you look at rural Minnesota, we know that a large proportion of the physicians and the nurses, the pharmacists, the public health workers are getting toward retirement. And we don't see enough people coming into the fields, especially to practice in rural areas or in some of our underserved communities. So we had a problem that's been growing for a while, but the pandemic just really exacerbated it. And it was both just the intensity of the work, but also you mentioned earlier some of the really difficult parts of the contention and people being so angry and accusing their physicians and their nurses of trying to do them harm, and wanting treatments that the health professionals wouldn't give them because they knew they were dangerous. It just became very, very nasty in some circumstances, which is really heartbreaking.
I had a neighbor who believed that Anthony Fauci was actually financially benefiting, had some investment, some stake in it. Mm-hmm. And he got COVID, this neighbor, and he refused treatment. He refused all things because he was so mad at Anthony Fauci. Oh. And he died.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I know.
That's a tragic story.
It is. It's a terrible story.
Yeah.
Like, he died at home by himself of this illness because he refused care because he was so upset and angry at the system. And I just think that's the intensity with which so many people really felt that it's all a bunch of hooey and they're just trying to get us. And it just feels funny because it's like at no point was anything malicious.
Right.
The effort and the intensity and it just feels funny because it's like at no point was anything malicious.
Right.
The effort and the intensity and the decisions that were made to try to help people not die. That was it.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge, there were costs to those things. And
sure.
That's very clear. I mean, people's businesses, with the learning disruption to learning with kids, not being able to be in person.
We're still seeing that.
It's a big deal. And I think that's why it's so important to take stock of, well, what did we learn? What would we do differently? Now, I think, if we could have more quickly gotten schools to adapt, and adopt policies to keep the school environment safer, would be a great goal to, let's, for heaven's sakes, improve the ventilation in the schools and have things like testing and vaccinations and rapid access to treatment for the teachers and whatever. I mean, just thinking about how to prepare and how to protect some of these critical sectors and nursing homes. Oh my gosh,
that was terrible.
Yeah, what a heartbreak. So how do we do a better job? I mean, nursing homes have struggled for a long time with infection control. They're short staffed. They need more training. They need more people. And along comes a pandemic into a situation that was already stressed.
Right.
So again, another thing that I think was such an important learning is how connected all these parts are. The hospitals were too full, both because, not enough people were taking preventive actions, but they also couldn't discharge people to the nursing homes because the nursing homes didn't have enough staff to take patients.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is connected, and we have to really be mindful of, you can't fix one problem in isolation and expect it to stay fixed. You got to look at the whole system.
Which kind of leads us to your conversation about the work that you're doing at the University of Minnesota. So why don't we do this? It's 7:32. We'll take a break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll do some weather. We'll let folks know what the temperature is and what it's going to be today and the next couple of days. And when we come back, we'll talk more with Jan Malcolm, former commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, as well about her new task force on health professional training at the University of Minnesota. We're back on 830 WCCO, broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. And we're back. We're broadcasting live from the Minnesota State Fair. It is 7:36 on a Sunday morning. Happy to have you with us. Nice to see people out milling about. The sun is shining. It's a little, I'd say, brisk, 56 right now. But, you know, we cannot complain about the weather because it was brutal last week. And so now we're finally reaping the rewards of a kind of a nice fall morning. Folks have got their coffee and a donut or whatever they're eating over there. I can't quite see, but it is making me hungry. I
think me too. We have hope you get a breakfast break at some point.
I'm going to run over there. We're talking to Jan Malcolm. She's on the porch, too. Jan is the former health commissioner for Minnesota. Also, she has a new job. She retired from that. And now you are. Tell us about this job, this task force. What's the mission of the task force?
Well, I'm really honored that Governor Walz asked me to chair a task force to help look at some of the challenges that are facing, particularly the University of Minnesota's health professions, health sciences programs, certainly the medical school, but also the nursing school and the School of Public Health and the School of Dentistry and all these important healthcare providers that, boy, look what we just lived through and how dependent we are on excellent healthcare workers and excellent public health workers to take care of us every day, not just in emergencies. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the aging of a lot of folks, particularly in rural areas and in some of our communities that don't have enough access to providers. And so that's been an issue. You know, how do you make sure that we keep training world-class health professionals to meet the needs of the state? And the university, and there are other, you know, important training institutions around the state too. So this is sort of about how does the state support the continued training of world-class health professionals. The university trains the great majority of certainly the physicians in the state. And we're just looking at some trends that make us concerned about the need to make sure that that we're supporting that training pipeline, because it's sort of so key to everything else. If we can't either do prevention or treatment to the standards that we've come to rely on, if we don't have a really high class workforce,
and so how do you do that? Yeah, I was going to ask, what's the solution?
Well, I think part of the issue is that we've got a pretty complicated healthcare system.
You know? I'll say,
yeah. I mean, we've got insurance, and we've got health systems competing with each other, and you know,
mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah, and everybody's rightly concerned about the cost of healthcare and the insurance premiums. And so in that environment, things like teaching and research tend to get squeezed. You know, it's sort of that pressure between the short term and the long term. And so the question is really, well, is there, what can the state do, you know, to support that, those public aspects of the mission of training health professions?
Is it about incentivizing? Is it about, you know, what do you do to attract people to get into the field? Like, are there things you can say, you get a bonus or you get a new car?
Nice idea. Yeah. Yes, I think there are some programs, and certainly the federal government's very important in how we pay for health professions training, but we do a number of things at the state to try to support that too. So it's time to just kind of look at how are those programs working, and do we need to do more, and what more can we do, and is there you know, kind of just thinking about who all benefits from the health workforce and what should be the way that the university partners with other health systems, with other schools, with the, you know, the technology industries that are so dependent on the health workforce. It's kind of like, again, it's kind of a good lesson from the pandemic that things don't happen just magically.
Right.
They happen, you know, with a strategy and with resources and with a plan.
Right.
And we just I think it's a really valuable time to kind of take stock of what's happening to the health workforce in Minnesota and how do we support it and strengthen it.
651-461-9226, that's the number if you can call, or you can text that on our Cities One Talk and text line, and we have folks back at the station that can get us that information if you have a question. Anyone listening out in the audience as well, if you have a question, you can jump up here on the porch and ask. But we're talking about this new task force. Tell me when it's going to start and what's the game plan.
This is this was created by the governor through an executive order just a couple weeks ago, and it's so under the executive order there will be 15 members of this task force. I'm the volunteer chair, so it's not a job exactly, but it's something I'm very happy to support and work with some of our leaders in the health environment on. So folks who are interested can apply on the Secretary of State's website, and the executive order specifies we need, you know, people with rural healthcare experience, people with experience in training, a diverse workforce, people who know about healthcare finance, a couple people specifically from the university, the medical school, and elsewhere in the university. People representing other health systems. So there are kind of criteria or skills or experiences that we're looking for on the task force. And that should be named in the middle of September, we hope, and get going with our first meetings at the end of September. It's a short task force. We are due to make a report to the governor and the legislature in January.
Oh.
So we are not going to solve all the problems of health care.
You're going to make recommendations, though.
Yeah. It is to say, what are some options for how the U might partner differently? What can we learn from other states? We're not the only ones confronting health workforce challenges. What are others doing?
Yeah.
So we'll surface some options, make some recommendations really aimed at helping the governor and the legislature kind of process the requests that they've already gotten from the university for more resources to support this mission.
How important is straight up money to incentivizing? I mean, like, because we know, like, the healthcare professionals, the personal service helpers, the pay is still terrible for a lot of people that are in health care. I mean, would that be a part of the solution?
Well, how do you make the workforce attractive, as you were saying earlier? You know, and certainly pay is an important thing. How do we, you know, and look at the parts of the system where we really have huge shortages. You mentioned personal care attendants, long-term care workers, primary care, mental health and behavioral health specialists.
Oh, sure.
I mean, and that too has to do with what are the pay scales for those jobs. It's a lot more lucrative to become a super specialist than a primary care doc, but we really have a critical need for some of those basic skill sets as well.
And I would imagine too, to some degree, perhaps the communities themselves that need the primary doctor might have. So if it's a Thief River Falls or it's a Mankato or, you know, Wilmer, those communities might find ways as well to make themselves more attractive to those providers.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that we do with some state funding, not a lot of state funding, but for instance, there's a program that helps support residency slots in some of those very communities, because we know that if people practice in a community, get trained in a community, it's more likely that they'll stay there.
Sure.
Practice in a similar environment. So there are things that we are already doing that we can look at how well is that working and can we beef it up. But I do think there are some other models in other states to look at, because again, it's like this is the public missions of teaching and research are kind of embedded in this really complicated healthcare financing world that's all about competition, and it's the market can't fix everything.
No.
I think there's a real role for market forces in competition, but there are also these kind of public aspects to the mission that need to be kept front and center.
It's very convoluted, and I'm constantly scratching my head about how wacky the healthcare system is in terms of money, and that, you know, there was a great article in Time magazine several years ago called The Poison Pill. And it was about the fact that, like, okay, so I break my arm and I don't have insurance. How much does it cost? Okay, I break my arm and I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and this is how much it costs to fix it. Mm-hmm. I break my arm and I'm on Medicaid, and this is how much it costs. So there's no cost. There's no straight up, okay, you break your arm, you're going to put a cast on, it costs $100. It's so messed up to me, and I don't know how you fix it, because I think the horse is out of the barn. I mean, insurance is here, Medicaid, Medicare, blah, blah, yeah. blah.
Well, and again, I think just want to reinforce, this is we've got a specific mission and a short timeline. So all those things that you just mentioned are part of the complicating factors that make us need to ask the question, okay, given the complexity of the healthcare marketplace, what does that mean for how we support the training of our future health professionals, and how should we make sure that we continue to be at the leading edge of research? We have so much to be proud of with our health system in Minnesota, both our health care and our public health. Again, we worked our hearts out during the pandemic, and I think, you know, time will, I think, just continue to show that we, you know, while not perfect by any means, we actually performed pretty well as a state, and that was due to the incredible hard work and skill of so many people. And we are right to be proud of healthcare and health in Minnesota, but we can't take it for granted. We have to be really mindful of, you know, the current challenges and what we're going to do differently in the future to meet some of those the things that we didn't worry so much about the pipeline for. Or where people were practicing. We've lost so much access in rural Minnesota. It's a real concern. So we have to figure out what are we going to do about that.
Sure. All right, we have to take our final break. It is 7:48 on News Talk 830 WCCO. My name is Susan Jones. Susan Jones, why did I say that?
I've never heard you say it.
I haven't. My mom calls me Susan Jones when I'm in trouble. Susie Jones is my name. 651-461-9226. We're back after this on News Talk 830 WCCO. Welcome back. It is 7:54 on a Sunday morning. Fair's starting to pick up. You can kind of feel the energy out there. Folks are milling about, having their coffee, having their donuts, having their crepes with ham and cheese, which I will be popping over. Jan Malcolm is our guest. She's the former health commissioner for the state of Minnesota. Jan, we have about, oh gosh, 1 minute. Isn't that terrible?
Wow, it goes fast.
So what we'll do is have you back on in when the report is ready. We'll talk about the
report. That'd be great.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, I know you're off to your place up north. I hope you have a wonderful week.
Thank you. It's been, I just want to say what it means. These last years have been difficult, but it's also been an enormous privilege to serve Minnesota.
Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate your courage as well in the fact that I know that it wasn't not easy dealing with the public who was very emotional. So thank you so much, Jan Malcolm, former commissioner of the state of Minnesota, Susie Jones, and we're back with Your Money on WCCO coming up right after this from the Minnesota State Fair.